And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 9th of August. Book lovers, bookworms, and bibliophiles celebrate National Book Lovers Day today on August 9th. American novelist James Baldwin said it best, "You think your pain and heartbreak are unprecedented in the history of the world, but then you read. Books help us understand each other, feel less alone, and put our complex emotions into words. From clay tablets to today's ebooks, literature has played a crucial role in preserving cultures, educating the masses, and storytelling. Thanks to Johannes Gutenberg's 15th century printing press, anyone, not just royalty, monks, or landed gentry, can read and own books. There are too many life-changing vegan books to list all of them, but here are five. Number one, Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. This book starts off with a personal story. The novelist Jonathan Safran Foer is about to become a father and decides he needs to make a final, informed, ethical decision about whether or not he and his family should consume meat. He then embarks on a journey where he spends years seeking an answer. He writes, "Just how destructive does a culinary preference have to be before we decide to eat something else? If contributing to the suffering of billions of animals that live miserable lives and quite often die in horrific ways isn't motivating, what would be? If being the number one contributor to the most serious threat facing the planet, global warming, isn't enough, what is? And if you are tempted to put off these questions of conscience to say not now, then when?" Number two, Animals and World Religions by Lisa Kemmerer. Dr. Kemmerer examines the role of non-human animals in scripture and myth in the lives of religious exemplars and by drawing on foundational philosophical and moral teachings. She begins with a study of indigenous traditions around the world, then focuses on the religions of India, Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain, and China, Taoism, and Confucianism, and finally, religions of the Middle East, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. At the end of each chapter, Kemmerer explores the inspiring lives and work of contemporary animal advocates who are motivated by a personal religious commitment. Number three, Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. You'll hear animal liberation referenced all the time in literature about veganism and animal rights. That's because this book is considered essential reading for animal rights activists, and for good reason. Singer was one of the first philosophers to lay out a moral argument against speciesism, or discrimination based on species. Although the book was published in 1975, Singer's arguments are just as sharp and relevant today as they were then, drawing inspiration from other liberation movements, including civil rights, feminism, and others. Number four, The Sexual Politics of Meat, a Feminist Vegetarian Critical Theory by Carol J. Adams. This 1990 classic draws a groundbreaking parallel between society's oppression of women and its systemic exploitation of animals. Adams points out an age-old link between patriarchal values and meat eating, arguing that objectification, fragmentation, and consumption are common themes in the way our society portrays, treats, and discusses women and animals. Veganism, Adams argues, is therefore a way to challenge patriarchal society. This provocative read has been changing minds and starting conversations since its publishing date. And number five, Liberate, Animal Liberation Above the Law. Stories and lessons on the animal liberation front, animal rights activism, and the animal liberation underground by Peter Young. From personal accounts of moving from protest to liberation, to facing a life sentence for freeing animals, to becoming a federal fugitive, to prison and beyond, Liberate contains over 30 essays, transcripts, and interviews on the principles and tactics of animal liberation above the law. This is the most comprehensive collection of writings and speeches ever assembled from within the secretive world of America's number one domestic terrorist threat. And here's a poem for today, "There Is No Frigate Like a Book" by Emily Dickinson. There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any coursers like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without a press of toil. How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul. There Is No Frigate Like a Book by Emily Dickinson. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder to read and write about animals today. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. Let's read chapter 4 of our book, Don't Drink Your Milk, Frightening Medical Facts About the World's Most Overrated Nutrient, written by Frank A. Oski, M.D. Chapter 4 is titled, Can Fat Be Fatal? Organizations such as the American Heart Association have strongly urged that the consumption of milk and other dairy products be reduced by Americans of all ages, and for good reason. Diseases of the heart and major blood vessels will kill about 1 million Americans this year. These diseases are responsible for 1 out of 2 deaths that occur in this country. Of these million deaths, approximately 2/3 will be due to heart attacks. Even more chilling is the fact that somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 deaths due to heart attacks will occur in individuals under 65 years of age, mostly men, in their productive years of life. We have done very little to change these statistics. Everyone knows that an infant born in 1977 can expect to live far longer than one born in 1900. The infant born in 1900 could look forward to a life of 50 years. While the infant born today can reasonably expect to live an average of 72 years. Unexpressed in these numbers is the fact that the increased life expectancy is a result of the elimination of many diseases that killed people during infancy and childhood. The eradication of many infectious diseases with vaccines, better care of newborns, and the general improvement of nutrition are largely responsible for these gains. When you reached age 45 in 1900, you had a reasonable prospect of living to age 70. Today, the 45-year-old person can expect to live to age 76. Why have we seen a gain of only 6 years in life expectancy in the last 75 years? Because we have yet to significantly reduce the death rate from atherosclerosis. Atherosclerosis, one of the group of blood vessel diseases called arteriosclerosis, is a disorder characterized by thick, irregular deposits on the inner lining of arteries. These plaques restrict blood flow through the artery and thus compromise the oxygen supply to the organs supplied by the artery. These roughened spots can break loose, cause rupture of the artery, by weakening the blood vessel's wall, or most importantly, provide a location for the formation of a blood clot. A blood clot in an artery would completely prevent blood flow. This process of vessel obstruction as a result of atherosclerosis can occur in any artery of the body, but it is most common in the large and middle-sized arteries supplying the brain, kidneys, legs, and heart. When blood circulation is obstructed in the brain, a stroke results. When the process occurs in the heart, it is termed a heart attack or coronary artery occlusion. The occlusion of one of the 3 coronary arteries results in death of the heart muscle, which the vessel normally supplies. Muscle or tissue death is called infarction. Hence the phrase myocardial infarction. to signify the consequences of impaired blood supply to the heart. What is the cause of atherosclerosis? Until the 1950s, most people believed that hardening of the arteries was just a normal accompaniment of aging. The findings uncovered during the Korean War changed all that. Autopsies performed on our young soldiers, most of them in their late teens or early 20s, revealed that almost 80% already had evidence of atherosclerosis. Subsequent studies demonstrated that early signs of atherosclerosis may be present even in children 2 or 3 years of age. The arterial vessel plaque deposition is a slow process that generally unfolds over 20 to 40 years. The plaques are rich in fat, most notably cholesterol. Most Americans, by the time they reach age 50, have evidence of severe atherosclerosis. Is this an inevitable process, or can it be prevented or retarded? The primary event that causes injury to the lining of the artery, which then becomes the site for buildup of the atherosclerotic plaque, is still unknown. What has been recognized, however, is that the disease occurs with increased frequency and severity when certain risk factors are present. These risk factors include high blood cholesterol, the ratio of high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, to low-density lipoprotein, LDL, in the serum, high blood pressure, diabetes, cigarette smoking, sedentary living, certain personality traits, and family history of heart attacks and strokes. The more risk factors present, the greater a person's chances of suffering the ravages of atherosclerosis at any age. The presence of an increased serum concentration of high-density lipoprotein appears to reduce the risk of heart attacks for any given serum cholesterol level. The concept of risk factors has grown out of studies supported by the National Institutes of Health in Framingham, Massachusetts. At the time of the study, this factory town outside Boston had a population of some 28,000 and represented an accurate cross-section of the United States in terms of economic status and ethnic mix. In 1949, some 5,000 healthy men and women between the ages of 30 and 59 were selected for careful study. Every other year, these individuals underwent careful physical exams and laboratory tests. Over the years, about 1,000 of these residents of Framingham had died. The factors contributing to their deaths have helped provide scientists with the data used to formulate the concept of risk factors. Because so many factors predispose to the development of atherosclerosis, it has been hard to identify any one alone as most important. While there is no unanimity of opinion, most investigators believe that a high blood cholesterol level is the most important risk factor, particularly when it occurs in association with a genetic or inherited predisposition to the disease. Diet is an important factor in determining serum cholesterol levels. Cholesterol is in the plasma and blood body tissues is derived from two sources, the foods we eat and the cholesterol that we produce in the liver and intestines. The typical adult in this country consumes a diet containing 600 to 800 milligrams per day, which is much higher than in most other parts of the world. This cholesterol comes from food products of animal origin, such as egg yolks, dairy fats, and meat. The more you eat, the more you absorb into your system. In addition, 500 to 1,000 milligrams of cholesterol are produced each day by the body. This production goes on almost independent of the amount consumed in the diet. Two substances in the diet appear to control the plasma level of cholesterol, the cholesterol and the saturated fat you eat. Saturated fats are usually solid at room temperature. Foods such as butter, cheese, cream, beef, pork, lamb, and chocolate are rich in saturated fats. The ingestion of saturated fats makes serum cholesterol levels rise. Unsaturated fats are usually liquids at room temperature. Corn oil, cottonseed oil, safflower oil, and other vegetable oils are rich in unsaturated fats. The ingestion of unsaturated fats makes serum cholesterol levels fall. The first evidence of a relationship between diet and atherosclerosis was provided between 1910 and 1920 by a Russian investigator, Nikolai Anishchev. Rabbits fed a diet rich in fat and cholesterol quickly developed atherosclerosis. Since that time, many animal studies have produced atherosclerosis by means of diets rich in cholesterol. It is obviously far more difficult to conduct similar experiments in man. Indirect evidence has been employed to demonstrate a link between diet, cholesterol, and heart disease and stroke. The Framingham Project indicated that men with a blood cholesterol level of 240 milligrams had three times as many heart attacks as men with blood cholesterol levels of less than 200 milligrams per cent. Surveys of the world populations have shown a direct statistical relationship between blood cholesterol levels and the incidence of heart attacks. In general, throughout the world, there is a direct relationship between serum cholesterol levels, atherosclerosis, and the consumption of dairy products and meats. There are about 35 grams of fat in a quart of milk, and about 60% of the fat of milk is in the saturated form. If you drink one quart of whole milk per day, you will have consumed over one-third of your daily quota of fat as recommended by both the American Heart Association and the White House Panel on Food, Nutrition, and Health. Drinking that much milk allows very little flexibility in the choice of other fat-containing foods in the daily diet. In addition, the consumption of milk fat, rich in saturates, provides almost all the presumed safe amounts of this component as well. Simple dietary changes can reduce the mortality from heart attacks. The most convincing evidence comes from a study conducted in Finland in two large hospitals with stable patient populations. From 1959 to 1965, patients in Hospital N were provided with a cholesterol-lowering diet, while patients in Hospital K were fed normal institutional fare. In 1965, the diets were reversed. The experimental diet differed from the usual diet in only two major respects. Whole cow's milk was replaced by a filled milk, an emulsion of soybean oil in skimmed milk, and a soft margarine rich in polyunsaturated fat was substituted for butter or ordinary margarine. The experimental diet produced an average reduction in serum cholesterol levels of close to 20%. More importantly, it reduced by over half the death rate from coronary artery disease among the males in the study, although other studies have also suggested the same beneficial effects from dietary modification. This particular study is most impressive in view of the minor dietary manipulations required to produce such a large desirable effect. The American dairy industry is also concerned that the fat in milk may be harmful. This is reflected by the large-scale production of skimmed milk and low-fat milk. Even ice milk has been produced as a substitute for ice cream. Prudent diets can reduce cholesterol levels and probably reduce the death rate from heart disease. Recent calculations suggest that for middle-aged men with normal blood pressure who do not smoke, adoption of a prudent diet alone can save 6 of every 100 of them from heart attacks. The benefits are even greater if other risk factors are already present. If the men were smokers who already had evidence of heart enlargement, commencing a diet designed to lower blood cholesterol levels would help 29 per 100 to escape heart attacks. Pediatricians have also been alerted to the important role they must play in the prevention of atherosclerosis. Authorities recommend that all children and families in which there is a parent or grandparent with a history of heart attack before age 50 be screened for evidence of disturbance in the way the body transports and regulates fat. Blood samples should be obtained by the age of 1 year in children from such families. The blood levels of cholesterol and triglycerides should be measured. If either of these is elevated, then further studies should be conducted to determine if a genetic abnormality in the fat transport proteins of the blood is present. Different types of abnormalities require different forms of dietary management. Some may require drug treatment as well. The most common of these inherited abnormalities in fat transport is termed type hyperlipoproteinemia. It affects about 1 in every 200 members of the population. It has been estimated that about 5% of males with this trait will develop evidence of heart disease by the time they are 30 years of age. About 50% will have heart disease by age 50 and 85% by age 60. In this, the most common form of inherited disturbance, the recommended diet severely limits the intake of cholesterol by reducing consumption of eggs, fatty meats, shellfish, and dairy products. Such diets should be instituted around 1 year of age. The consumption of cow's milk from an early age may have lifelong consequences. Changes that are believed to represent the forerunners of atherosclerosis have been observed in the coronary vessels of infants and children. One pathologist has reviewed the heart vessels of more than 1,500 children and adolescents who died as a result of accidents. Deaths were a result of auto injuries, drownings, gunshot wounds, and related traumas. These children and adolescents had not died as a result of disease. Yet many of them showed signs of diseased arteries in the heart. When an attempt was made to unravel the factors responsible for the fact that some of these children and adolescents had normal blood vessels and others did not, the single feature that most clearly distinguished the two groups was their early feeding histories. The majority of children with normal blood vessels had been breastfed. The majority of children with diseased vessels had been fed cow's milk or cow's milk-based formulas. It is therefore reasonable to conclude that the differences between human milk and cow's milk were responsible for the early changes in the coronary arteries. All the findings that link diet to atherosclerosis underscore the belief that cow's milk was not designed for human consumption. The lifelong consumption of milk is not practiced by any species of mammal except humans. Atherosclerosis is unknown among other mammals. It can only be produced by the feeding of human-type diets, diets rich in fat and cholesterol. In February of 1977, the United States Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs released a document titled Dietary Goals for the United States. In this report, one of the recommendations was that Americans reduce their intake of fat and suggested that efforts be made to reduce the intake of milk and other dairy products. Many organizations, including quite naturally the National Dairy Council, challenged the recommendations. In 1982 came another salvo. The National Research Council issued a report titled Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer. This report was a milestone in that it represented the first time any official body had suggested that the risk of cancer could be reduced by dietary changes. Among the recommendations was that the proportion of calories provided by fats should be reduced from 40% to 30% in the average American diet. The report stated, of all the dietary compounds studied, the combined epidemiological and experimental evidence is most suggestive for a causal relationship between fat intake and the occurrence of cancer, particularly cancers of the colon, breast, and prostate. The diet designed to help reduce the incidence of heart disease may also reduce the risk of cancer. The American Heart Association called it a prudent diet. No guarantees, no money-back offers. It does appear, however, that it would be prudent to reduce fat intake if it might prevent both heart disease and cancer. 1 quart of whole milk per day adds 35 grams of fat to your diet. 35 grams represents about one half of all the fat you should consume in one day if you are the average 150-pound man. Is that the way you wish to spend your fat allotment? Even more exciting is the evidence that is accumulating that suggests that eating less of the proper foods may actually extend the normal lifespan. In the June 8, 1982 edition of the New York Times, Jane Brody, in an article titled "Eating Less May Be the Key to Living Beyond 100 Years," summarizes the animal data that suggests that longevity can be increased by consuming a diet containing all the proper nutrients, but a third less calories than are needed to maintain a normal body weight. The benefits of proper nutrition can be gained even when such a diet is instituted in middle age. All the evidence to date has come from animal studies, but there is every reason to believe that they are applicable to humans. Reduce your fat intake and reduce your caloric intake, you may find yourself eating for a much longer time than you thought possible. During the first year of life, the infant should be fed human milk or a commercial preparation that resembles human milk as closely as possible. A variety of milks are now available for that purpose. After 1 to 2 years of age, the time of normal weaning, milk should be removed from the diet. That was chapter 4 from Don't Drink Your Milk by Frank A. Oski, MD. We will read the next chapter next time. You, like me, maybe have heard people talk about Jimothy the raccoon, who has recently come to fame. So I did a little looking into it and thought it would be interesting to read one of the many stories that have been published recently about this raccoon. This story was published in The Conversation, and the title is "Jimothy the Raccoon Survived Against the Odds, a Testament to Sophisticated Brains and Devoted Mothers." As a neuroscientist who studies raccoons and rats, I see the viral story of Jimothy the raccoon as a compelling tale of an animal overcoming disability and surviving in the wild. Jimothy, the unique-looking raccoon living in Seattle, became an internet celebrity over the course of a week in July 2026, thanks to a viral Instagram post that has amassed millions of views and thousands of comments cheering for the proverbial underdog. Jimothy has even been honored with a city proclamation. Something about him was obviously different. His body and tail were unusually short, and his back was curved. Although Jimothy hasn't been officially examined by a veterinarian, he's thought to have a form of a rare cervical vertebral malformation called short spine syndrome. A handful of cases has been seen in dogs. These animals are born with a condition that prevents their vertebrae from fully developing. With less physical space in the body, organs are crowded into a smaller space than usual and can lead to mobility issues. Adaptations are necessary for these animals to navigate their environments and secure the necessary resources for survival. How did Jimothy overcome the odds and emerge as a survivor? The sophisticated raccoon brain. Although it's easy to imagine a pet dog that's under the close care of human pet parents surviving a challenging condition such as short spine syndrome, the probability of a disabled or injured wild animal successfully living in the uncertain outdoors is a different story. Even for healthy raccoons, it's a challenge to survive the harrowing time of being a helpless newborn. Up to half of young kits die without emerging from the natal den. If an individual raccoon is among the fortunate to leave the den as a juvenile or young adult, life's challenges don't stop there. Typically, there are no safe zones that are reliably protected from predators. To survive, raccoon have to be vigilant, persistent, and physically agile to navigate the physical and mental challenges of life in the wild. In fact, it's so dangerous out in the wild that many raccoon only live 2 to 5 years, even though they have the capacity to live for around 12 years in captivity. It's difficult to imagine how Jimothy has navigated life's challenging terrain to survive in the wild. However, if any mammal can transcend the limitations of a disability, raccoon would be at the top of my list. Very few studies have been conducted on the raccoon brain, but my lab's limited research has revealed the neuroarchitecture of a complex and sophisticated brain. Raccoon have exceptionally high neuron densities, resembling those of small primates. More neurons lead to greater flexibility in behavior, a characteristic that is likely facilitating Jimothy's survival. My team also identified the presence of specialized and fast-conducting brain cells called von economoneurons, which are typically located in the areas of the brain involved in emotional, social, and internal processing in people. And perhaps the neuroevolutionary piece de resistance of the raccoon, their hands. The forepaws of raccoon are extremely dexterous and sensitive and occupy a large portion of their brain's motor cortex, like that of people. This investment in hand movement takes raccoon learning abilities to the next level, explaining why Toronto paid roughly $24 million U.S. dollars to develop raccoon-proof trash bins. These brain capabilities likely give Jimothy some neural backup as he navigates narrow fences, climbs trees, searches for food, and scopes out places for rest and refuge. Jimothy's mom as hero. Equally impressive as Jimothy's own adaptations is the continuous care provided by his mother. As challenging as the raccoon mother's role is while raising her young, raising a kit with special needs likely requires extra energy and patience. For raccoon families, the mother is very much a single parent. Not only does she not have help from the father, but she often moves the litter to different dens to escape the threat of males potentially harming the kits. She also needs to be an efficient forager to prevent excessive time away from her vulnerable offspring. Unlike many mammals whose young become independent soon after weaning, raccoon mothers continue taking care of their kits for much longer. Although nursing typically ends around 16 weeks, raccoon youngsters often remain with their moms for up to 9 months. From weaning to leaving the natal den, maternal raccoon take their family through something like homeschooling. One of my favorite examples appears in the PBS documentary Raccoon Nation, where a raccoon mom takes her kits on a field trip to teach them how to collapse their spines to slide past a wooden garage door. For hours, she models the behavior for her young, then observes their attempts, catching them when they fall and nudging them to try again. It's apparent that Jimothy's mother was no exception to the prototypical raccoon mother, serving as nurturer, protector, and teacher. Based on the videos of older Jimothy running across a field, navigating fences, and exploring his world, it appears that his mom's hard work resulted in a remarkable return on her investment. Evolutionary perseverance. Even though the odds were stacked against Jimothy from the day of his birth, he persevered. Jimothy is being celebrated for being different, but in my opinion, the most interesting aspects of his story are two remarkable evolutionary achievements that all mammals share: a brain capable of adapting to an imperfect body and other life challenges, and a patient and caring mother or guardian who translates her offspring's capabilities into abilities. Jimothy's mom celebrated his value long before his video debut and viral following. This article was written by Beth Daly. Interesting. Interesting that this has come to public light and what it shows about raccoons and their ability to take care of each other, even the ones who are disabled. And here's a story from Veg News. Could Oregon ban hunting, fishing, and animal farming? Campaign reaches major milestone. More than 140,000 people have backed Oregon's Peace Act, a proposed ballot measure that would remove animal cruelty exemptions for hunting, fishing, and farming. This article was written by Charlotte Poynting. More than 140,000 people across Oregon have signed a petition to end fishing, hunting, and animal agriculture in the state. A campaign called Yes on IP28 has submitted a petition to Oregon state officials in support of the People for the Elimination of Animal Cruelty Exemptions, or PEACE Act. The proposal, also known as Initiative Petition 28, would amend Oregon's animal cruelty laws by removing exemptions for fishing, hunting, and animal agriculture. Animals on farms, research labs, exhibitions, and in the wild would no longer be allowed to be intentionally injured or killed, abused, nor would they be allowed to be forcibly impregnated, sexually assaulted, states Yes on IP28. Animals in transport trucks or in the industries already mentioned could no longer be deprived of adequate food, water, and shelter, neglected either. The Peace Act hasn't officially qualified for the ballot yet, as state officials likely won't make a final decision until August. If it qualifies, it will be put to a popular vote in November. This is the third time campaigners have tried to push for amendments to Oregon's animal cruelty laws, but this effort is already looking more promising than previous ones. In 2022, the organization gathered 2,000 signatures, and in 2024, it collected 40,000. This time, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals provided financial support for the campaign. Will the ban actually pass? David Michelson, a spokesperson for Yes on IP28, says that despite the progress, the ban is unlikely to progress this year. Still, even making it onto the ballot would be a win, he told Current Affairs in 2025. And the organization has no plans to back down if it doesn't pass. Our goal is to be persistent, he said. We take part of our inspiration from the U.S. women's suffrage movement, which used the same strategy to get the right to vote. Indeed, in Oregon, the Women's Suffrage Initiative passed on its sixth attempt. It is definitely our hope that this initiative will draw attention to the vastly different ways we treat companion animals compared to animals currently on farms, in research labs, and in the wild, he added. His hope isn't misplaced. Some similar initiatives have passed in the U.S. in recent years, although none have been as far-reaching as the Peace Act. In 2018, for example, California approved Proposition 12, a state ballot initiative that prohibits the sale of eggs, pork, or veal from animals kept in extreme confinement. And in 2025, new rules against the extreme confinement of mother pigs went into effect in Ohio. Fish meal feeds livestock farming, sometimes at the expense of marine ecosystems. This story comes to us from Sentient Media, written by Gaia Cabico. Some pig and poultry farmers incorporate tiny fish into feed because of the nutritional benefits, but critics warn that over-extraction of these fish could disrupt the marine food web. People usually associate livestock feed with soy and grains like wheat and corn, But farmers also feed pigs and chickens fish meal, a protein-rich powder made from small wild fish, such as anchovies and sardines, and fish processing scraps like internal organs and trimmings. Each year, hundreds of billions to more than a trillion tiny forage fish are caught and processed into fish meal and fish oil. Critics argue that producing fish meal requires harvesting enormous numbers of forage fish, species that are the cornerstone of marine food webs and that help transport and store carbon in the ocean, which can ripple through entire ecosystems, adding pressure to oceans already stressed by climate change. When you remove them, you're not just removing a fish, but you're jeopardizing the health of other fish that are dependent on them, which then means that you're also jeopardizing the health of human communities that depend on larger fish, says Adriana Netsoulas, campaign director of a coalition opposing offshore fin fish farming called Don't Cage Our Oceans. From oceans to feed mills, aquaculture consumes more than 90% of the world's fish meal, and pet food uses another chunk. Pig and poultry farming today account for about 3% of global demand. But before aquaculture expanded in the 1960s, pigs and chickens were the main consumers of fish meal. Terrestrial farmed animals like pigs, chickens, and cattle never ate fish until we began to feed it to them, Jennifer Jacquet, professor of environmental science and policy at the University of Miami, tells Sentient in an email. Hog and poultry producers use fish meal, because it provides a highly digestible, dense source of protein and essential amino acids, vitamins, minerals, and omega-3 fatty acids. Research shows that adding fish meal in the diets of young animals can improve feed intake, growth, and immune function. However, one study found that replacing fish meal with soybean meal or poultry byproduct meal in broiler chicken diets resulted in heavier birds and higher feed intake without affecting the amount of feed needed to gain weight. Alternatives to forage fish for animal feeds include insect meal, algae meal, and feed crops such as soy. Several of these options have a much lower environmental impact than fish meal, while providing equivalent or higher nutritional value. Ellen Pickich, executive director of the Institute for Ocean Conservation Science at Stony Brook University, tells Sentient in an email. While these alternatives could help reduce pressure on wild fish populations, they also come with trade-offs. Soy production, for example, can contribute to deforestation and biodiversity loss, while insect-based feeds face challenges related to scalability and energy use. Plant-based sources of protein like beans, however, do produce fewer greenhouse gas emissions than seafood. Downstream effects of fish meal production. Forage fish species such as sardines, sand eels, menhaden play a vital role in marine ecosystems. They feed on plankton and serve as prey for larger fish like tuna, sea bass, and salmon, as well as seabirds and marine mammals such as whales, seals, and dolphins. As a result, harvesting large quantities of forage fish for fish meal and fish oil can affect the biodiversity and resilience of marine ecosystems, advocates and scientists warn. A task force led by Pickich and composed of marine and fisheries scientists found that at least one predator relies on forage fish for half or more of its diet in 75% of the ecosystems they examined. In nearly 30% of ecosystems, at least one predator derives 75% or more of its diet from these tiny fish. According to the task force report, an anchoveta fishery in Peru, the world's largest single-species fishery by volume, illustrates the importance and vulnerability of forage fish. Nearly all of the catch is processed into fish meal and fish oil. In the 1960s, Peru's anchoveta harvest had reached 10 million metric tons, contributing to sharp declines in seabird population that depended on anchovies for food, when a strong El Nino struck in early 1970s, the combination of high fishing rates and low stock productivity triggered a collapse of the anchoveta population. Another example is heavy fishing of Atlantic menhaden in the Chesapeake Bay in the U.S., which likely reduced food available to striped bass, bluefish, ospreys, and bald eagles. Scientists have also raised concern that technological advances in fishing could lead to the potential depletion of Antarctic krill, considered forage fish even though they aren't technically fish, slowing this recovery of severely exploited baleen whales. Although forage fish can recover quickly under favorable conditions, scientists say several populations that collapsed because of overfishing have failed to rebound, such as the anchovy and sardine stocks in northern Benguela off Namibia and southern Angola. In 2024, more than 18 million tons of wild-caught fish were processed into fish meal and fish oil, according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. This is a considerable decrease from the peak in 1994, when around 30 million tons were processed for these products. Based on this trend, the organization has concluded that aquaculture growth has not increased pressure on reduction fisheries at global level. Reduction fisheries are those that catch fish for fish meal and fish oil. However, the Food and Agriculture Organization also says the total amount of fish meal produced is expected to increase by 13% over the next decade. Jacquet argues that catch data alone does not fully capture the pressure on fisheries. She stresses that industrial fishing fleets have increasingly used advanced technologies that allow them to maintain catches even if fish populations decline. We should be ecologically concerned with any farmed animal systems, Jacquet writes. We know this is unsustainable. Increasing forage fish capture also requires fleets to travel farther and use more fuel. Matthew Hayek, an environmental science professor at New York University, tells Sentient in an email, this could deplete marine food webs further and emit more greenhouse gas emissions, Hayek writes. In many parts of the world, forage fish are also an important source of food and income. News outlets De Smog and The Guardian reported earlier this year that industrial vessels were illegally catching sardinella within or near Bajos Archipelago, a biodiversity hotspot often called the Galapagos of West Africa, to supply offshore floating factories that process fresh catch into fish meal and oil for export to global salmon and shrimp farming companies. De Smog and The Guardian also reported that this extraction disproportionately affects local women who traditionally process and sell these small fish, reducing their ability to earn money. Scientists are calling for precautionary strategies to protect forage fish and their predators. At this point in time, the stringency and enforcement of forage fish management regulations are not sufficient to prevent overfishing, writes Pickett. In 2012, the task force she chaired recommended limiting catch rates to 50% of the level typically used to achieve the largest average catch and doubling the amount of forage fish that must remain in the ocean. Later that year, California adopted a policy recognizing the importance of forage fish to the state's marine ecosystems and preventing the development of new forage fishers and expansion of existing ones without full scientific review. In 2016, the National Marine Fisheries adopted similar precautionary measures, restricting direct commercial fishing for several forage species in West Coast waters. For Natsoulis, using forage fish in animal feed reflects an industrial food system that she argues benefits a handful of corporations at the expense of the environment and coastal and rural communities. These fish, she says, should not be used to feed either farmed fish or terrestrial livestock, but instead should stay in the seas. The best thing we can do for the planet, for the oceans, and for all the other species of wild animals is to eat a plant-based diet. Plant-based News published a story called The Sheep Detectives. New Hugh Jackman film has an animal rights message. The Sheep Detectives has been compared to classic family films that center animals, like Babe and Watership Down. This story was written by Liam Pritchett. Hugh Jackman's new movie, The Sheep Detectives, has an animal rights message. The family film had its UK cinema release in May. It has received overwhelmingly positive reviews from moviegoers and critics alike, made a significant impact at the box office, and has even prompted some viewers to stop eating meat. The Sheep Detectives is about a vegetarian farmer, Jackman, who reads detective novels to his flock of sheep every night. When a sudden and mysterious incident interrupts life on the farm, the sheep take on the role of detectives to investigate neighbors, follow clues, and attempt to solve the mystery themselves. While Jackman's character is a wool farmer, learn more about the reality of the wool industry elsewhere on Plant-Based News, the film depicts his relationship with his sheep as positive and caring. In fiction, the farmer rescued one of his rams from a carnival where he was made to fight dogs, and one of his neighbors, a butcher, dislikes his meat-free lifestyle. A subplot of how killing them is murder. Writing in the vegetarianism subreddit, one person said that the sheep detectives inspired them to stop eating meat and become a vegetarian themselves. Meanwhile, in the vegan subreddit, a user described the entire message of the film as being how smart sheep are, with a subplot of how killing them is murder. The Sheep Detectives has been compared to Babe, the critically acclaimed 1995 film that prompted its lead actor, James Cromwell, to go vegan, and the classic but notoriously distressing animated adaptation of Watership Down from 1978. The Sheep Detectives is directed by Kyle Balda, who made Despicable Me 3 and two spin-off Minions movies, and written by Craig Mazin, who is best known for creating HBO's Chernobyl and for co-creating and co-writing The Last of Us TV show. The star-studded cast of The Sheep Detectives. Alongside Jackman, The Sheep Detectives stars Nicholas Galitzine, Masters of the Universe, Molly Gordon, The Bear, Brett Goldstein, Ted Lasso, and Bella Ramsey, The Last of Us, along with Emma Thompson and Bryan Cranston. The Sheep Detectives was released in May, but is still showing in select UK cinemas. It launched on Amazon Prime Video at the end of June and will come to DVD in August. The new film is based on the novel Three Bags Full, a sheep detective story by Leonie Swan. According to Sony, the sheep in the movie were all created digitally. And to wrap up Animalia Hour for today, I just wanted to read a very short amount from a TED Talk given by Sean Munson, who is the director of the Earthlings documentary. In that speech, he said, 8 billion humans currently consume 80 billion animals every year. And just to repeat that, 8 billion humans currently consume 80 billion animals every year. It's about a 10-to-1 ratio, and it does not include seafood, by the way. That's a fact. Which begs the question, how is it we can feed 80 billion animals, some quite large, namely pigs and cows, but we can't feed 1 billion humans? Most of them are children. Something is very wrong with that math. Animals, by the way, are poor caloric converters. In other words, it takes, for cows, for instance, 16 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of feedlot beef. If you took $16,000 to the bank and they gave you back only $1,000, you might be a little upset. You might even want some sort of restitution or grant or subsidy to offset your loss. According to the World Health Organization, 1 billion people go to bed hungry every night. 500 million at the door of starvation. 80 billion animals, on the other hand, are not starving. In fact, the meat industry hopes to double that number by 2050. That's because they want you to buy more of their product. They want you to eat more meat. Now, how on earth are we going to feed 160 billion animals when we can't feed 1 billion people? I'll tell you how, and maybe some of you can guess already. By clearing forests. We cut down or burn down forests to create grazing land for these billions of animals, or grow food to feed these billions of animals before then killing all these animals. Okay? Two machines at work here. One is the burning machine and one is the killing machine. The problem is we've already cleared 50% of forests. 50% of the Earth's forests are already gone. Talk about deforestation on a global scale. This is not a sustainable way of eating. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.